Good evening, everybody. Don't know where to start. This evening I will give you a brief talk about practice of insight meditation. Many of you would probably be familiar with it. Tonight I'll speak of it in a slightly different light. I call it functional vipassana. If you are familiar with this word, or rather if you are not familiar with this word, this vipassana is insight meditation. That is being real. I would call vipassana as being real. And to be real means being mindful. Usually I give this definition in the beginning of a retreat. That means the first thing to learn in a retreat is to be mindful. And to be mindful means being real. Yes? Because when you talk of mindfulness, it is a state of mind. But when you talk of vipassana, insight, meditation, means to be mindful in a way that brings about insight or realization into things as they really are. From practice, I would say that if we want to be more precise into what mindfulness is in insight meditation, it means to be really clearly aware of the nature of reality, of what things really are, which means one has to be completely open to it. Yes. And reality is always in the presence, here and now. And if one is really open to it, open to reality, then mindfulness is automatically there. See, the mind has, when you speak of the mind, it talks of two things. The mind is defined as the phenomena that knows the object. That means there are two things involved, the knowing and the object. If you can allow the object to be things as they really are, then mindfulness is automatically there. The other way is to arouse the state of mind as far as one understands what mindfulness is, then the object becomes a real object. There are two things involved. You can approach either way. The basic principle behind it is if you are one with truth and reality, there's no suffering. There is only peace. happiness. That's the basic thing. And so, vipassana is bringing the mind, bringing oneself to the state. As simple as that. You know, if we just be really present here and now, then reality is there in front of you and you have peace. It's as simple as that. But the people's mind have been very complicated. And so they've forgotten how to be, do that. When things are too simple and the mind is too complicated, then you undergo the whole process to bring it back to that simple state. And so if you step one step forward, usually I step one step backward and define mindfulness as a state of mind which is clear, peaceful, and soft. If you can bring the mind to this state of clarity, peacefulness, and softness, and just let it be in the present to know what it is experiencing, then you can say that you have mindfulness. If you can do this continuously, the clarity, the peacefulness, and the softness of the awareness is being increased. And the nature of reality becomes clearer and clearer. Yes? Do I make myself clear? Ah, okay. So you have many systems whereby we do that. Many traditions, many lineages that basically come to this point. Right? Now this is for beginners. Okay. So now we come to this topic of the talk, functional vipassana. Yes. These are for the why people. In other words, why we are doing this, why we are not doing that, you know, for the why people. I happen to be one of those why people. The other thing that I've encountered in the practice of meditation is to bring the practice of vipassana insight to daily life. Because a large amount of time we spend is in the daily life. The trouble is, many would think that in daily life they cannot achieve anything or much. You know? Especially those that have gone for retreats and they've gone into deeper levels of concentration, they find that, well, I can't get much from daily life meditation. Yes? I don't think so. You can still do something. That's why I say insight meditation in daily life, not just mindfulness meditation, not just concentration meditation, but insight meditation in daily life. Because I believe that this truth that we seek for is also present in our daily life. It's not as distant as we think. You know? So that is one of the reasons why I choose this topic, functional meditation. Because if we know why we are doing, as to what we are doing, then we will know that it's worth doing, and it is worth doing well. I hope I'm not making things too complicated. So I put these functions simply into four functions, or three and a half. First is clearing, and the function of clearing. This is synonymous with the word purification, but I was advised not to use this word. Anyway, there's a big book called The Path of Purification. So I suppose clearing is a better word. Yes? But purify in the sense of, not in the sense of, you know, what, evil, but more in the sense of healing. Healing of the mind from this kind of mental sickness or weakness. What they call, in what they usually call defilements, or mentally negative and unwholesome states. This is nothing secret. It's all over the place. But it is not something as what we call something very evil, no? Like someone once asked me, well, how do you find spirituality? I would say that spirituality is bringing oneself as close as possible to the reality and truth. And if one can do that, the mind becomes more and more peaceful, more and more clear. You know? And that's basically what spirituality is. So this is clearing. You know? Because the untrained mind has many of these negative tendencies, you know? Coming conditioned from the distant past, not in this, just this life, but in the past lives. And so if it is untrained and it is subjected to a lot of conditions around it, unfavorable conditions, then all these mental negative tendencies and mental sickness, they arise. You know, it's like a dark cloud, like the demons in your mind that's being activated, the viruses in the mind computer that is being activated. And what happens is chaos. One definition of the word dukkha is chaos. And personally, it's called suffering. So this chaos happens, and so we have this clearing. Once I had this very strange incident, because I used to run a meditation hermitage in Asia, and very often I'm not there. And once when I came back, the whole place was littered with leaves. But there was a caretaker there. And I asked him, how come you don't sweep these leaves? He said, the whole hermitage is full of leaves because it's in a forest type of environment. Then he answered me, why should I sweep the leaves? If I sweep them, they will fall down again. I'm wasting my time sweeping the leaves. So I asked him, well, why should we meditate? We meditate, the defilements can come back again. So similarly is in the nature of the mind. You know, we have to keep clearing the mind. Because if we don't, it's going to be worse. Because we never know how chaotic the mind can be. When the mind breaks, then it's very difficult to mend back again. But if we know it is not just that moment of clearing, then the clearing function takes us much further. One thing that connects our practice is the aspiration. that within our mind there is this aspiration to reach to the unconditioned, to go as far as we can beyond the mundane. If you have this faith and this aspiration, every act of clearing contributes to that path. If you do not have this, then it will just be, it will give you a very happy life anyway. That's why it makes a difference between what we call a parami and not a parami. Parami is a perfection that takes you to the other side of the shore. So every time we try to be mindful, we replace the negative state with a positive state, with the unmindful state with the mindful state, the restless mind, the suffering mind with the pure mind and the happy mind. And if you do it with great clarity of the present moment, the function links it to the higher goals. Especially if you have the basic principles of vipassana insight on the present moment, on the three universal characteristics, on the nature of here and now, to be really aware of the nature of here and now. The clearing also has that connection, has that linkage, has that direction involved with it to some degree. And it is cumulative if your aspiration is clear and established. Like this, all the energy and all the karmic energy is being put in that direction. And this is a big deal of work, you know. Every time all this craving, anger comes out, you know, you clear it. But you do it happily and mindfully, because like they say, cleaning a toilet is a happy thing. It's not always pleasant, but you know, once it's clean, you're very happy. Now we come to the second function. The second function is strengthening. A strong mind is a happy mind. But strength here is attributed to the positive or the clear, wholesome nature of mindfulness. Including peacefulness and gentleness. This softness of the mind has often been associated with weakness. Sometimes we think we to be strong, we have to be aggressive. No. We have to be, you know, really hard. No. We call it macho. Sometimes it's the opposite. Because we're talking about different type of strength. Strength in goodness, in softness, in all those positive quality. Because things like strong anger, actually you don't call it strength in the real sense, it is called weakness. Because you have no control over conditions, you're just totally subjected to the conditions that cause suffering. So strengthening of the mind come under the territory of what we call right concentration. And I don't say just concentration, right concentration. That means the concentration with mindfulness, concentration that comes with clarity, concentration that comes with softness, concentration that comes with peacefulness. And in this aspect, one thing I would like to emphasize, this right concentration also comes with kind of peaceful joy. I don't know about here, okay, but often I meet with these very serious practitioners that become too hard on themselves. And when they're very hard on themselves, sometimes this joy factor goes out. For example, recently I met a practitioner who has been to Burma many times. She's an American. But she does not really, she isn't really happy. She's serious, but she's not happy. And ask her these three basic qualities of mindfulness: softness, clarity, and peacefulness. She says she doesn't have too much of them. And this is what I mean by strengthening. Strengthening these qualities that contribute to right concentration or right mindfulness. You may be amazed, no? Concentration sometimes comes easier when you are not so hard on yourself. Concentration comes when you are really soft with yourself, but with a clear directed purpose. With a mind with a clear direction. Sometimes I see why these people, this often occur more with ladies, I think. They just sit and they sit for 5 hours, 7 hours. I can't do that, you know. I say, what's the secret? And finally, I began to discover they're actually enjoying themselves. They're really being happy and sit and they actually enjoy. The only difference that is they have still have mindfulness. They're not clinging and attached to it. There's just the clarity, natural clarity is still there. And then they sit and they're enjoying the sit. I mean, that's why they can sit long, because they're enjoying it. Sometimes this word enjoy is a taboo word in meditation, because you're clinging and craving, you know. It's not necessarily so. And through the years of practice, I noticed that this is one of the most important factors for deepening of concentration. You know? It is considered as the proximate cause, this is Abhidhamma definition, the immediate cause of concentration. If you have mindfulness and clarity and the joy comes in, the concentration just deepens right through. You know? Like you are really happy with something, you stay there. Simple as that. You know? And you're really happy with it, you forget about everything else. All you need is to maintain the clear mindfulness and you won't go wrong. That's just one more thing involved. And that pure, clear mind will be really strong and deep. So the strengthening of the mind means to be able to keep this mind pure, this clear, peaceful, soft mind, all as long as possible. And when it's long, the strength naturally becomes stronger. Another thing I would like to share with you in this limited time is the concentration is not static. Because concentration is a state of mind. It does not just stay there like you take a stick and poke on the ground. It's not that. The mind is like a moving stream. The strength of the concentration of the mind is the strength of the current of the water. You have an idea the mind is just one whole thing that fixed on it. It's not a very realistic model. It does work, you know, but it's not a very realistic model. A realistic model will be a very powerful river that flows in one direction. And why does it flow in that direction? It's because of the training involved. It has been all conditioned to do that in the training. That's why the intensive meditation from morning to night, it makes a difference. So when the mind is really strong, it also takes one, links one to the supramundane. No? Because when you talk the mind is really strong, that means the mind is pure, the mind is clear all the time, as in those people who are fully enlightened. And how is that possible? It means it goes to the deeper levels of the mental existence. So that's where the strengthening of the mind works. And the deepest levels of the mental existence is arrived at because of mindfulness, insight. No? There is some kind of debate here that how strong the concentration should be. Yes? And some insist that you go to the level of absorptions, whatever the absorptions are. Sometimes they have conflict, you know, what are absorptions, because you're talking of experiences. Some maintain that they don't. No? I prefer the second one, although I practice absorptions. Because, you see, if a mind is able to be one with reality in everyday life, you need some degree of deep concentration, but not so much that it's impossible for ordinary men. So now we come to the third function. The third function is sharpening of the mind. This is where the process of insight comes in. This is not yet going to insight directly yet. It is still the process, the basic conditionings. Sharpening the mind is just like in one of the frequent simile given in the suttas, is that the ear of wheat, not the ear of the wheat. This is one of those, we call it the glooms. We are more aware of botany. Of the glooms, the structure that is very sharp. It's not very strong, it's a bit hard, but it is sharp. If you use an ear of wheat and it is well directed, it can pierce the flesh and draw blood. This is the simile given. It means when the sharp mind is very sharp, it may not be so strong. It's a cutting edge. As we know, a sharp mind is also very useful in daily life. If you are not sharp enough, you miss many things, many opportunities. So in the world, people sharpen their minds for worldly purposes. In insight meditation, we sharpen the mind to recognize how to recognize and pick up like things like the realities, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. The mind is sharpened to be able to pick up this nature of these realities. The realities are always there. It's just is that your mind is not open to it, not sharp enough. Then even if it's right in front of you, you don't know it, you don't recognize it. This sharpening process has a number of steps to simplify things. The first step is opening, to be open. The sharpening of the mind is like a camera taking a sharp photograph. Before you can take any photograph, the lens has to be open first. It has to be clear, right? Otherwise there's no photograph. So there is to have this basically very open mind. It sounds simple, but it's not so simple because the mind is, there's already a lot of things there. So that's why they call it bare attention. The first thing is, don't think, which is something very difficult nowadays. Just don't think. The less complicated societies is quite simple when they don't think anyway. So it's less one step. They just need to know what is mindfulness. When they don't think and they are mindful, okay, that's vipassana, you know. But now there's an extra step in the thinking, so they have to switch off the machine first. Sometimes it's difficult to switch off the machine because it's on for so long. So the first step is, you know, try not to think. Try not to think. Learn to start switching off the thinking, at least for some time. And second is, there has to be that, what we call that, faith. Faith in the sense of openness to learn and to receive and to know what is happening. To have faith, to have an open mind, doesn't mean that you believe everything anybody says. There's a difference, you know. That means you have to, at least if you're listening to a talk, at least you listen and consider. This open mind. In meditation is the mind being open to experiences. The basic, as I said, the basic conditions like mindfulness must be there. So you learn to let your mind be more open and more and more open to the real objects to arise. For example, in the beginning of mindfulness meditation, you have to be open to your body sensations. Body sensations are the first and the grosser objects of vipassana. Yes, but yet, many people cannot feel much sensations in the body. Usually they try to focus on the breath. Yes, in, out, one, two, three. Now, this is one small point. Sometimes they use more of concentration than mindfulness. They imagine a point here, probably a round spot or something like that, and then they concentrate there, right? Or here. When they ask them, what actually sensations do you feel? They don't feel much. If they can feel something, they more tend to end up with samatha, tranquility meditation, and vipassana. Because when they don't feel much and they can hold the mind there, concentration results. But they don't get into vipassana. Vipassana, you have to see very fine and many changes that are happening there. So you have to be very mindful before it goes into vipassana. Alright? But never mind, you go to samatha first. When your mind is calm, then maybe it will be more open. So that is why I feel that the body generally is a better vipassana object. Because it's like a bigger window. This is like a keyhole, you know. Now if you cannot feel much of the sensations in this whole body, how are you going to feel the sensations at this little spot? It's basically the same thing, the sensations in the body, this is also part of the body, right? So once you have dealt with the sensations of the body clearly, then it doesn't matter where you watch, in the nose or the rising and falling abdomen or the touching, anyway, it doesn't, it's basically the same thing. That's what we mean by opening the mind to these basic physical sensations in the beginning. Once you're open to this nature of the basic sensations, then you can be more open to finer things like the feelings and the consciousness. You could gradually you move from the getting to receive, to know the grosser objects, then you go to the finer objects. So this opening of the mind is one thing. Second is the reception. That is the sensitivity of the mind. These are basic things that has to be trained. A sensitive mind is like a sensitive plate of film. When the film is very sensitive, even in the dark, you can pick it up. It's just how sensitive the mind is to pick up. And this comes with training. That is why in meditation, we sometimes didn't report, we ask for people who watch the rising and falling abdomen, how is your rising and falling of the abdomen? It goes up and down. Of course, you know. I want to know more. And then you put a hand and you try to feel very hard. It means that they're just concentrating. They feel something, but they're not really so mindful of what's happening there. Even pain, which is something very strong. Say, please describe your pain. Oh, it's very painful. Just, yeah, I know it's very painful, but please describe, I want to know more. The leg is very painful. I'm not asking where it is painful, I want to know the nature of the pain. You know? And so slowly they describe, they ask for more and more, where the rising falling begin to discover. It's not so much like up and down, it tends to go all over the place sometimes. Sometimes it's more like expand and contract. And sometimes it even rolls. Basically it's the sensations that are here around the abdomen or in the body, not necessarily the anatomy. And so as you keep looking and looking, then the sensitivity is being developed. Yes? That's why I find that one of the important qualities of a Vipassana practitioner is insatiable curiosity. No. Curiosity kills the cat, it's true. But it also gets you to the root of things, you know. They say Vipassana, there are two types of people. The really curious to want to discover, and there are those who have suffered. Let's get out. So it's better to be the curious, you know, because suffering is not so nice. Hopefully you don't have to suffer to get out, so much to get out. Once you have these two, then it's the training in clear perception. Clear perception is having, not just receive, but having a clear focus of the photograph. Yes? This clear perception can be very precise. That's why there is, sometimes in personal report there is a precise way we want you to report, you know. Sometimes people come and report, they tell the whole life story. Once I had a person that came to report, said, in the morning I woke up, it was a very clear mind, and I looked out the window. There were birds singing and flying around. And after that, I took a sigh. I mean, it was a long report. I said, not necessary to go to all those details. I don't mind if I have the time. No? If you have the time, we listen, because especially beginners, it reveals the state of the mind, the objects and all those. No? Because in the beginning of a retreat, when yogi come, I said, haha, what's this person? They're looking into a Pandora's box. Is this person going to freak out or go crazy, or is he going to watch? You know, because we don't know who the person is, you know? You have to be careful. Usually it doesn't, but once in a while, you know, there are such people, so you allow them to talk, you know, if you have time. But sometimes there's so many people, you don't have so much time to talk. But later you have to be more precise in the report, because the more precise you report, then it shows the more precise your perception of the object. This is showing the clear receptivity and perception of the object that is being experienced. This comes with a very clear mind, a sharp mind. That's where the part of the clarity of the present moment takes place. Then there's another part in this sharpening of the faculties, in the sense that this knowing that these objects that you experience is not a static thing. That's what the difference between a vipassana and tranquility meditation objects. It is a process. And so when it's a process, the object is a changing thing. It's constantly being transformed moment to moment. And so you have to allow it to. The vipassana object is an object of convenience. It is not an object that you hold on to. It's like a river. When you travel along the river, you don't hold on to the water. You flow with the water. But you know how it is like to flow on the water. There's a difference. Like, for example, in the beginning of the meditation, you say we don't hold on to the object, you follow the object. It's like taking the dog for a walk. You know where the dog goes. You expect the dog to walk a straight line, B line, from point A to point B. It doesn't work, because it doesn't go that way. Nature doesn't go that way. It moves all over the place. But you, if you train it, you can get quite close to the object. Then you know what the dog is up to. And what the dog is about. In other words, it's having a, what we call an open type of awareness to the change. This is a slowly sharpening in that, to the mind, to the nature of the object. That where it comes to the last half of the function. The last half of the function I would call true vipassana. The first three, clearing, strengthening and sharpening, has relevance to the last part. When you're very clear, things become sharp. When the mind becomes very strong, clear mind, it is very well focused on that reality. And when it's very sharp, it penetrates into the reality. So, but the last one is a well directing, is having the cutting at the right point. Like, for example, if you have you want to break through a wall, right? And you have a hammer, it's not very sharp, and you hammer all over the wall, right? If you have time and enough strength, the wall will probably break down anyway, right? But if you have a very sharp knife and you know where the weakest point is, and you have this sharp axe, with one stroke you may probably break through the wall. Right? And you keep hitting, and you're hitting the same weak point, then you get through the wall faster. Right? So this illustrates my point about the functional vipassana. You can't always have the sharp axe all the time, especially at the beginning. Your axe is not sharp anyway. So when you have the hammer and you know the wall is there and you keep hammering, something is being done. At least you start weakening the wall, So with practice, the hammer becomes sharper and you become know where the cracks in the wall are. And you start cutting at the right point, and pieces will keep falling off. Yes. So this directing is basically directing the sharpened, clear awareness into the nature of reality. The nature of reality is basically here and now. If we come back to the first thing, the definition of what mindfulness is. I believe we can be very clear and sharp and just be present and don't think. Don't think who is being mindful, what is being mindful, but just being totally present. So whatever objects that arise to your mind, immediately it disappears. Because everything becomes something that is created by the mind, concepts created by the mind. So it's just the one point of reality of the here and now, and you're really clear about it, that is just that direction. That is one thing. But usually what happens is brought step by step. It's going into seeing the three universal characteristics. We say first you direct the mind in such a way that it is clear. There's no greed, anger, delusion or the hindrances there, five hindrances there. And after that, you start directing to the mind to the experiences that are freed from concepts, panyati. It means freed from all the thinking, freed from all the words, thinking, words, form and shape and space and time and persons, and all the other abstract concepts in what is happiness and what is suffering and what is reality and what is illusion, all the concepts concerning it. So you take your mind from all these concepts, then you fall back into what they call paramattha dhammas. Usually the translation for paramattha dhammas is ultimate realities. Actually it's not ultimate, it's just a translation. It's ultimate in the sense that if you ultimately take away all the concepts, that's what you end up with. Ultimate in that sense. So I would call it inner realities. So you end up with those phenomena, experiencing those phenomena. We call mind and material characteristics, specific characteristics. But this is again only the surface. If your mindfulness of the present moment, the nature of these things, what finally goes through is ends up with what we call the three universal characteristics: impermanence, moment to moment change, suffering, which is the oppressiveness that comes through the moment to moment change, and non-self is the nature of reality. Non-self has two definitions. One is the, we call the absence of the ultimate controller or the soul or things like that. And you may have heard of that. This is the negative definition. Negative in the sense that it removes wrong views and wrong opinions and ideas. There's a positive definition, which is things as they really are, which are the, again, the three universal characteristics. This is something that you experience directly when you don't have any concepts, when you have pure mindfulness here and now. What you experience is basically anatta, non-self. Yes. So when the mind is being directed to this, so the mind gets closer and closer into this reality. For example, impermanence. When you direct your mind at impermanence, you direct your mind towards change. For example, in the beginning, you may watch the breath, the sensation of the breath, or the rise and fall, in, out, rising, falling. You feel the movement and the tension and all those. But you don't hold on to that. If you just have your real vipassana mindfulness, finally you only see change. That means you don't direct your mind to the hardness or softness or the movement, which is automatically up there. You direct it to the moment-to-moment change. That means the process, the flow. It's like you don't direct your mind to the water, but the flow of the water. There's a difference, The flow comes with the water, But you first have to see the water first before you see the flow, right? But once you direct it to the flow, then you're directing more to the characteristic of impermanence. But when you direct it to the characteristic of impermanence, anything you see disappears. So finally what you're looking, nothing. Is it? Because the moment you see it, it's not there. So what are you looking at? This is thinking. You cannot think. That's where it goes beyond your concept, totally all concepts. You just bring your mind to that state and you find out. Okay? That's basically where it goes beyond words and expressions. So that's where the directing become more precise. What is there finally? Whatever is there, what is there to say about it? Right? If your mindfulness is strong and clear, you experience it. No? And so again, impermanence, or this, when people say impermanence, suffering or non-self, these are also basically concepts to understand. But when you go into practice, it gives you the idea of the direction. So what is there, which means things as they really are, things which is present. And this is the actual vipassana that you come to. But this cannot be arrived at unless the basic functions, the basic conditioning of clearing, strengthening and sharpening must be there. Yes? Once this conditioning is strong enough and you just direct it to things as they really are. Whatever is there, let it be. You know, just sit and let it be. And that is the directing. Yes? In the beginning you tell people everything is emptiness. No, you may imagine that you are enlightened, but I don't believe you, at least not me. Because basically the basic conditions of a sharp, clear mind must be there. Yes? I think 5 minutes for some questions, because I thought 9 o'clock people are supposed to be leaving. Yeah? So I think if anybody wants to go home, they can go home. This is what I'm supposed to say, I think. So let's have many duties to take care of. So those who want to ask questions can ask questions. I've actually summarized 1 week's talk in 45 minutes. Any questions? Yes.
I have a question just about clearing.
Yes.
And like, is clearing like observing, like if the mind keeps coming back to say past experiences and then your body starts suffering, you just observe?
Clearing mind is continuously linking your willpower to producing the clear mind.
Staying at it.
It's just like, no. The first step of meditation is to clear the mind, which means to produce mindfulness, to arouse mindfulness. So if you have an idea of what this clear mind and mindfulness is, with your willpower and attention, what we call attention, manasikara in Pali, you just switch the button here and it's just like, you know, you're sleepy, you try your best to be awake, you know. And then you become more awake. After that, it dims again. No, wake up, and then you become awake again. No, this is in a very gross manner, but very slowly you become more refined. You know how to make your mind clear. You know, we are, you know, in a normal way of speaking, we are in control of our mind to a great extent. If we are completely no control of our mind, now we are crazy. You know, the mind just goes crazy. We are able to, and so we are able to produce the type of mind that we want. You know? It's only that because of habits, if we just leave it, the mind goes into its own habits. And what you're trying to create is the good habit, mindful habit, so that if you keep conditioning your mind in such a way that you don't make any effort, the mind stays mindful. You know? But in the beginning, you have to keep creating the clear mind, the clarity, you know, mindful, the clear, peaceful, soft mind. whenever you find that the mind getting hard, soften up. When the mind getting dark, clear it up. When the mind getting disturbed, calm down, more peaceful, you know. Mindfulness is more of manipulating the state of mind and keeping the state of mind in such a way and developing in such a way. Usually people do it in terms of reference to objects. How you see the object, how the object behaves. You know? But meditation more precisely is the mental control, mental conditioning. Yes.
Is it necessary to Is it necessary to gain an understanding of the things that happen in meditation such that they can be verbally expressed? Because sometimes I find that things happen and I don't really I try to look at what they are, but I don't really understand them, and then as they will, they go away. And I think, well, did that do anything?
I think it is important.
Okay.
You need to know what's happening and what is going on, you know. And I suppose to be able to communicate with that, you need some basic knowledge. It depends very much with the people you're associated with the teachers involved, you know. But I do believe you really, because insight is knowing what is happening. Even you have a strange, some people have strange experience, but they don't know what it is. That's dangerous, you know. It's a strange experience. You're going to uncharted territory. You need to know what's happening. Yeah. Yes, any more questions?